And from the KTOO newsroom, I'm Anna Canny. The Alaska legislature struck a deal on the state's budget late last night on the first day of the special session. It boasts a significant boost in public school funding and a $1,300 permanent fund dividend. The deal came after a failure on the last day of the regular session when the House adjourned before even voting on the Senate's budget. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trainin reports.
Senate leaders say they negotiated with the House members late Wednesday night and throughout the day Thursday. The deal ultimately contained extra money for several local projects for members of the House. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, says finally getting a list of capital budget requests from the House majority helped seal the deal.
We worked off their list, and that's the majority projects that were in that budget.
The budget has money for a new roof for the Palmer Library, $2 million for fixing the Mary Avenue storm drainage system in Anchorage, and harbor float replacements in Dillingham, among other items. It also contained a small amount for childcare grants and a new program to fund local medical care options. With energy in the final weeks focused on the budget, the legislature adjourned without passing several high-profile bills, including one to reform involuntary commitment laws for mentally incapacitated people, and it didn't pass a program pushed by the governor to pump greenhouse gases back into the ground. Stevens says the body learned some lessons so it can be more productive in future sessions.
The lesson is follow the schedule. You know, we all know there's a schedule. We all know there's a time at which you cannot go to a conference committee. We just all have to pay attention to that, and we will. I mean, that's my intention next year.
Throughout the last weeks of this year's session, the House and Senate were divided over the size of the dividend, with the House favoring a figure more than double the $1,300 ultimately approved. But House leaders couldn't muster the votes to dip into savings to pay for it. The final budget included a provision to pay an additional $500 if oil prices are above predictions. Delana Johnson, a Republican from South Anchorage, says that was important.
Would we have liked it to be higher? Well, absolutely, that too. But, you know, sometimes you only get to meet in the middle.
The bill passed the Senate 15-1 and the House 26-14. All members of the House minority voted in favor of the bill, while the Republican-dominated majority split, with some leaders voting against it. It now goes to the governor, who can still veto the bill. Governor Mike Dunleavy is currently on a charity bear hunting trip, his office says, and he hasn't publicly commented on the budget.
That was AKPM's Lex Trainin. When two major tribal organizations pulled out of the Alaska Federation of Natives last week, many wondered how AFN's board would respond at its quarterly meeting that happened this week. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, the state's largest Native organization is saying very little and is asking its early leaders to do the talking.
After AFN held its quarterly board meeting, it announced it was looking ahead to this year's convention and only made brief mention of the departures. Instead, it asked a few of its founders to reflect on AFN's history. Emil Noddy, the first president of AFN, said he was glad to speak, especially to address today's leaders.
They're living the dream that their grandparents sacrificed for.
Sacrifices, Noddy said, that came at a great personal cost for AFN's early leaders, who went mostly unpaid for their efforts. Some even mortgaged their homes, and they weren't alone. Native families across the state gave what few dollars they had to help AFN win one of the largest land claim settlements in U.S. history. Noddy says today's leaders have good educations and high-paying jobs, things they take for granted.
AFN is a gift to them from their ancestors.
The sudden exit of the two tribal groups brings the total number of organizations that have left AFN to five, including three influential Native corporations. But Tlingit and Haida's departure from AFN in particular has been a sore point for early leaders like Emil Noddy, who cast the deciding vote to allow Southeast Alaska Natives to join AFN. Other regions opposed the move because Tlingit and Haida had already received a settlement for land claims, but Noddy says that amount was far too small and unfair because it didn't include land. He also felt the inclusion of Southeast Natives would make AFN a stronger organization. Rosita Worrell, who also spoke to the AFN board, agrees.
It was that unity of Alaska Native people coming together. What would have happened if AFN moved ahead without the largest region?
Worrell is head of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, a nonprofit founded by Sea Alaska, the regional corporation for Southeast Alaska. She says Lincoln and Haida's departure from AFN affects both Sea Alaska shareholders and tribal members who should have been included in a wider conversation.
None of us had any inkling of it.
Both tribal groups have said their needs have changed and believe they can be more effective advocating for their own interests. But Worrell says she and other Native leaders are left wondering if this move was meant to undermine AFN's longtime president, Julie Kitka. Worrell hopes this isn't true because she says Kitka has been highly effective. She pointed to AFN's Alaska Day Summit in Washington, D.C. this March, which gave a large group of Alaska Native leaders a chance to sit down in the same room with six White House cabinet members and four generals.
We have someone at the leadership helm who can pick up a phone and call the White House and can command that kind of presence of national leaders.
Included in that Alaska Day Summit was Lincoln and Haida's president, Richard Peterson, who says he hopes to continue to work with AFN despite the change in membership status.
I get that it's a big deal, but it's really not a big deal. To me, this wasn't an anti-AFN move. This was a pro-Lincoln and Haida move.
Peterson says if AFN needs Lincoln and Haida's support on issues they agree upon, it will be there to help.
Don't be surprised to see me walking the halls at AFN, and I just won't be voting.
In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Alaska's death rate from traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs, is the highest in the nation. That's according to a recent report from the Alaska Health Department. Dr. Catherine Newell is an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention assigned to Alaska. She put the report together.
The fact that one in four deaths in Alaskans aged under 30 was related to a TBI is a shocking statistic, as so many of these deaths are preventable.
Traumatic brain injuries range from a mild bump on the head to a deadly punctured skull. The report looked at rates of emergency visits, hospitalizations, and deaths for TBIs over a five-year period from 2016 to 2021. Suicides and accidental falls targeted the most TBI deaths in Alaska, and Newell says there was a lot of variation between age groups.
For old adults aged over 85 years, 72% of TBI-related deaths were due to unintentional falls, whereas in younger adults, the largest proportion of deaths were due to suicide.
According to the report, Alaskan Natives and American Indian people were disproportionately likely to have serious or deadly brain injuries. Vehicle crashes seriously injured or killed the most young adults, and for people in northern Alaska, ATV and snow machine accidents were likely to cause serious head injuries. Over 40% of the deaths due to traumatic brain injuries were suicide by firearms. Newell says that prevention is really the only cure for traumatic brain injuries. Because the causes of TBIs vary so much, she suggests a wide variety of options to prevent injuries.
A good strategy is to think about how we are supporting our older community and our elders to prevent slips and falls, especially in the winter months.
The report mentions existing community programs that give ice cleats to elders. Other suggestions include firearm safety education, healthcare screenings for elders, and free helmet giveaways. The report also found many people had trouble getting care after they experienced a traumatic brain injury, usually due to cost or geography. Two Alaska Native organizations are creating lending institutions dedicated to funding clean energy and environmental infrastructure projects. The Valdez Native Corporation launched Alaska Green Capital, the state's first green bank, earlier this year. And Spruce Root is joining a coalition to form a national green bank. These banks can access newly available funding through the federal government and from private foundations, and then distribute that money to local businesses and individuals through low-interest loans. For the Valdez Native Tribe, projects could range from carbon-absorbing kelp and oyster farms to hydroelectric plants. Separately, Spruce Root, a nonprofit that supports entrepreneurs in Southeast Alaska, says their new money will target renewable energy initiatives to address the high cost of diesel power and transporting goods. Meanwhile, Governor Dunleavy introduced legislation last month to set up a green bank for the state, called the Energy Independence Fund. But that bill didn't get enough traction to pass this year. For more stories, check out ktoo.org.